Sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri, as an educational service in the public interest. I'm your host, George Gordon. The Law Hour is heard nationally on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5 over North America and worldwide on the Internet 7 days a week. For more information about the Law Hour and the Gordon Law School, please go to my website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report right after this message. Hey, are you concerned about your privacy? How much does your government know about you, and how much do you want government to know about you? Well, believe it or not, government only knows as much about you as you tell them about yourself. Everything that your government, industry, or business knows about you is because you told them you filled out a form and handed it in. Now, the Fourth Amendment protects you when your person houses papers and facts, but it doesn't protect you from yourself. Now, can we have privacy in the computer age? Well, you bet we can. And that's because information is gathered and stored in a very reasoned and logical manner for later retrieval and use. It's knowing how information is gathered, what information is stored, what information you want to keep personal and private that actually puts you in the driver's seat in your quest for privacy. And always keep in mind that no one knows anything about you that you haven't revealed by your own hand or your own mouth. Now, if you'd like to learn more about privacy and privacy issues, why don't you call and ask for my free general law CD package? That's a four-hour program. It's entertaining, informative, educational. Best of all, it's free of charge. All you have to do is call and order yours at 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to the webpage, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine and send an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, if there's no solution to the problem, then we don't need to talk about it. Fortunately, the economic problems facing the United States of America are simple to cure. You know, if you would just do the opposite to what you're now doing, it would reverse out what has been done. Or is that too simple? There was a time in America when we had gold and silver coin, we had little or no debt, we had a growing economy, stable values, and no problems. We went to paper money, and our debt grew, our money is unstable, and now we have problems. Seems like to me, if we go back to doing what we were doing, we could eliminate the problems that were developing from paper money. In other words, if what you were doing was working nicely and you decided that you wanted to make a change because you thought that things were going to work even better, you were going to make more money. And then you found out, gosh, I'm making less money and things aren't going as well as I had anticipated. Have you ever thought about going back to doing what you were doing before? Now, the impediment to that is that most people are waiting for somebody else to do it for them, guide them, direct them, instruct them. You see, our founding fathers created a monetary system with gold and silver coin, and they gave it to us, and they enforced it. It was just everybody uses gold and silver because that's what's in circulation. Well, that doesn't make any money for the bankers, the hangers-ons, and the lazies that don't want to work. So they came to us and they sold us paper money in the form of a U.S. national bank. And paper currency was born in the United States right after gold and silver coin in 1794. And we had a U.S. national bank for 20 years, and then they renewed it for another 20 years until it was vetoed by Andrew Jackson in 1834. But even with the paper money, gold money working together, it worked out a whole lot better than no gold or no silver at all, which is where we're at today. Fortunately, in 1986, our gold and silver was returned to us. Some of us have gone back to using gold and silver, and I'm one of the few guys in America that is not complaining about OSHA, the EPA, the State Tax Commission, unemployment insurance or workman's compensation, the IRS, inflation, paper money, the economy. I'm not complaining about any of that. Now, I did. There was a time when I complained about all of the above and more, and that's when I was in the national economy. That's when I was in the banks. That's when I was practicing usury and interest and paper money and credit cards and debt and usury. And boy, I had lots of complaints. And then one day I remembered what the old-timers had told me. No debt, no banks. And I thought, well, gee, maybe if I stopped paying interest, stopped doing business with the banks, maybe my problems would go away. And sure enough, I tried it and they did. I've been out here championing that for a long time. And then somebody pointed out, well, gee, that's what God told you clear back at Mount Sinai. He told you not to practice usury and interest. Don't use unjust weights and measures. Don't do business with banks. Don't charge interest or usury. Don't pay it. And you'll get healthy, wealthy, and wise. And so I went back to it, and sure enough, it works like a shot. And that's really the solution, because you're not going to find the Federal Reserve coming to grips with reality and saying, okay, our experiment with paper failed, and let's go back to what worked. Let's go back to gold and silver. You're not going to find the politicians, the banks, the businesses, and everybody else doing that. And so, in short, it's not going to be easy. It's not impossible. It's just not easy. It's much less convenient today than it was when I was a kid. You could take a silver dollar into the bank, put it on the counter, and she'd give you a paper dollar for it. You could take the paper dollar, put it on the counter, she'd give you a silver dollar for it. It's not that convenient today. It's not impossible. You can still do the same thing. It's just that it costs more, and it's not as convenient, and it's not as easy. Now, we had this problem clear back in colonial times. So let's take a little historical review, and then in the last program in this series, we'll take a look at here are the practical steps. Here's the practical solution to your problem. Every individual in America has access to gold and silver coin. Anytime you want to close your bank account, it's closable. Anytime you want to stop paying usury and interest, it's possible. Anytime you want to stop practicing and participating in the fiat money system and come to grips with facts instead of fantasy, you can do that. You, your family, your individual, you as an individual, you can do that. You're not going to get the Federal Reserve to do it. You're not going to get your state or state government to do it. You're not going to get the federal or agencies of the federal government to do it. You're not going to get Walmart on the bandwagon, but you don't need to. You don't need to. You see, I haven't converted Walmart to gold and silver, and I'm out here buying and selling to Walmart, and I don't have any problem with it. I haven't gotten Bank of America to convert to gold and silver, and I'm not having any problem. The IRS and the U.S. government and the state of Missouri, they won't use gold and silver, and I'm not having any problem with any of the above. And I'm happy as a clam at high tide, and you can be too. Now, paper currency got started in this country a long time ago. In fact, it started in December of 1690. It started in December of 1690 in Massachusetts, when they issued 7,000 pounds of printed bills of equal value with money. And then they did the same thing in May of 1691 and in July of 1692. They made all of these bills of public credit current within this province in all payments equivalent to money accepting specialties and contracts made before the publication of this new law. So they created paper money clear back in the 17th century here in North America, on the North American continent. Well, gee, how did it work out for them? How did they do it? How successfully were they at it? As a result, almost immediately, all of the coin then in Massachusetts was exported to England, and new stock followed as fast as it came in from abroad. Trade and commerce declined, and hard times came upon the people. What happened in America when we got into paper money? We got into World War I. We had a recession right after World War I in 1921-22, had a Great Depression in 1929-39. Commerce and industry declined, and we lost our gold in 1933. Same thing happened when we tried it in 1913 to 1940, as happened in 1690 to about 1720. You know, what goes around comes around. He who fails to learn from history is bound to repeat its mistakes. Americans hate history. We don't want to read dull, dry old history books. We go to public school where we can learn alternative lifestyles. Drink Coca-Cola and chase girls and lay the neighbor girl in the back of your Chevy van. That's the purpose for school. Sex education. Well, listen, if you don't want to learn from history, don't let me get in the way of your happiness and success. You just go out there and do whatever it is that you're doing and whatever it is that makes you feel good, whatever it is that you think you want to do, and let the devil take the hindmost. I'm not here to try to convince you that I'm right. I'm just here to tell you this is the way the game is played, and you can play the game that way if you want to, or maybe if you want to make a change, here's the way to do it. So we've experimented with paper money. We did it in South Carolina. We did it in Great Britain, New Hampshire, Connecticut, New York. We did it in Rhode Island, South Carolina, Massachusetts, and I mean not just once or twice. We did it in 1690, 1691, 1692, 1697, 1700, 1702, 1709, 1710, 1712, 1714, 1728, 1733, 1740, 17, you know, come on guys, we've been making paper money for a long time. Pennsylvania, in March of 1723, issued bills of credit for loans to individuals and not only compelled creditors to receive the bills at par or lose their debts, but ordered sellers to receive them at their nominal value in the sale of goods or lands or tenements or forfeit a sum from 30 shillings to 50 pounds. This law, so wrote Adam Smith, bears the evident marks of a scheme of fraudulent debtors to cheat their creditors. You know, the next development of the colonial system of paper money was a partial repudiation and recognition of the evils of such a practice. So the people of South Carolina had already recorded their sense of their mistake in the statute of the 11th of December of 1717, in which they said, "It is found by experience that the multiplicity of the bills of credit hath been the cause of the ruin of our trade and commerce and hath been the great evil of this province, and that it ought with all expedition to be remedied." Now the people of South Carolina said, "You know, we made a mistake here. Let's go back to gold and silver coin." They didn't solve their problem. When people are looking at the facts, when we're actually looking at reality, we can solve our problems. It's when you're in fantasy land, out in the land of Oz, that you can't solve your problems. You cannot take a fantasy, replace it with another fantasy, and come to grips with reality. Never has happened in the past. I don't see any prospect of it happening again in the future, or happening for the first time in the future. If it's never occurred before, why would we expect it to occur in the future? But you see, we've been raised and nurtured on a fantasy called evolution, where we believe that given enough time, anything is possible. That's a lie. It ain't true. Has never been true. Isn't going to be true. And you can believe in that fantasy if you want to, but that isn't where reality is located. Now, let me make a bold statement. I can take anybody of average intelligence. I don't need a Colin Powell or a Rumsfeld or a Dick Cheney. I just need a person with average intelligence, you know, out around 100 to 120, somewhere along in there. I mean, hell, you don't even have to be very bright. Intelligence, you know, is not that you're stupid. Intelligence measures the ability for you to solve a problem faster than somebody else. So a guy with 160 IQ solves problems faster than a guy with an IQ of 120. But it doesn't make any difference. If the guy with an IQ of 200 is living in fantasy land, he'll never solve that problem. I don't care if he works on it for the next 300 billion years. 2 and 2 is never going to equal 5, and you can work on that problem until hell freezes over. It ain't going to change anything. So you can take a guy who's not too bright, his IQ runs at 100 or 120, and if he puts his mind to it, he can solve the problem. It just takes him a little longer, that's all. It takes a little longer to solve the problem. I'm one of those. I'm just an average Joe Sixpack. You know I'm not too bright, but I'm not brain dead. And I'm interested in looking at history and finding out, well, what happened in the past when we used paper money? I can't find any example in history over the last 5,000 years where we've been recording and writing down what we're doing, where we have gone off of gold and silver and used clay tablets or papyrus or debased coin like copper and silver or gold and copper, where we have tried to adulterate our money, where it's been successful. In fact, in my study of 5,000 years of human history, I can't find a single example of success anywhere. I can find many, many failures. Now, if you want to fail in the money system, you just keep right on doing what you're doing. You write off and see if you can get another $10,000 credit card. And my God, if 15% interest is good, can you imagine how much better 30% interest is going to be? Now, boys and girls, if 15% interest is bad, 7% interest is bad, 1% interest is bad. It's just that it's not as bad as. But if you take 1% interest compounded, you're going to come up with the same destruction that you will with 15% interest compounded. It's just that it takes longer. It takes longer. I don't want to take longer. I don't want the red death pill or the green death pill. I want the white life pill, and that's available. The white life pill is available. Listen to this. On the 9th of January, 1739, the General Court of Massachusetts made this confession. They said the emission of great quantities of bills of public credit without certain provision for their redemption by lawful money in convenient time has already stripped us of all of our money and brought them into contempt to the great scandal of the government. For the remedy thereof, this province has fixed the value of their bills in lawful money and the time of their redemption in 1742. But that year went by and relief had not been found. So in 1744, James Allen, the preacher of the annual election sermon, addressed the governor from the pulpit thusly. He said, quote, "Be the means of delivering us from the perplexing difficulties that we're involved in by an unhappy medium, uncertain as the wind. The land mourneth, and the cries of many are going up into the ears of the Lord of Sabbath." Well, in February of 1748, Massachusetts invited the governors of Connecticut, New Hampshire, and Rhode Island to join in the abolishing the use of bills of credit, but as no one of the three gave effectual heed to the summons, the people of Massachusetts then proceeded alone, by themselves. So in January of 1749, Massachusetts passed an act redeeming the bills of the old tender at the rate of 45 shillings, those of the new tender at the rate of 11 shillings and 3 pence, for one Spanish milled silver dollar. The bills of credit of New Hampshire, Rhode Island, and Connecticut were excluded by most stringent laws. Massachusetts, with its quickened industry and established credit, subsequently sat as a queen among the provinces. All right, now let me tell you what my personal experience was. I used to operate a company called Atlantis Manufacturing Incorporated in Boise, Idaho, using credit cards, debt, and usury. One day, I woke up to the reality that my ship was sinking. Just like the leaders at Enron, WorldCom, and Global Crossing, at some point in time, it came to their attention that their ship was sinking. Having gone to Harvard Business School, having been educated, having been handicapped by a fantasy, they could not correct the sinking ship. They couldn't shut off the holes in the hull. They couldn't prevent the ultimate end. Now, depending upon how much water is coming into the ship, like the Titanic, you know, they calculated and they said this ship is going to sink in about 2 hours and 20 minutes. And sure enough, it did. You can calculate the amount of water coming in and about how big the ship is and about when it's going to sink. Any of you people out there with credit card debt, with debts in general, and with an income can sit down and do the arithmetic. Even if your IQ is down around 100, you could actually do that. It'll probably take you a lot longer than a smarter guy with an IQ of 160. But you can do it. The ultimate end is you're going bankrupt. You're going out of business. You're going to lose all your toys. When I see a man with a house worth $200,000 and he has an equity position of $100,000, I say, there's a man that's sitting in a sinking ship, and he doesn't know it. He's making his payments. He's bailing the water out as fast as it's coming in. Or he's bailing the water out almost as fast as it's coming in. And he can see that he is postponing the inevitable sinking at some indefinite time in the future. And he has high hopes that at some point in time he's going to be able to bail the water out faster than it's coming in. That's the illusion. You're never going to get to that point while you're in debt. So the first thing I have to do with a student who comes to school here with a debt problem is I've got to get him to up to zero COD. I've got to get you out of debt. You cannot make any money while you're in debt. All of you people who are in debt are going to live the rest of your lives in poverty. Now, if I can never get you up to zero COD, you're just 36 months away from having $100,000 in gold buried in a hole in the ground. That's right. If you will practice these 15 or 16 or 17 financial or economic laws of the scripture, in 36 months, starting at zero, just like your forefathers did when they got out on the plains, starting at zero COD and 160 acres of land, in a period of time, they could amass enough money to move to Omaha and build a $7,000 Victorian mansion on one square block and circle it with a wrought iron fence. They could do that in about 30 or 40 years. They could start at zero and do that. I can have you with $100,000 worth of gold buried in a hole in the ground in 36 months from zero COD if you've got an IQ of around 100 to 120. I mean, you don't have to be brilliant. You can't be stupid. And you have to face facts and hard, cold reality. And if you can do that, we can make money. If you can't, don't waste your time here. Now, our forefathers back in Massachusetts in 1749, they took a look at what they had done from 1690. Now, it took them 60 years to figure this out. But in 60 years, from 1690 to 1749, after they had initiated paper money, went broke, they woke up one day and they said, you know, if we would go back to doing what it was that we were doing before, maybe things would turn around. And sure enough, Massachusetts, with its quickened industry and established credit, subsequently sat as a queen among the provinces. Now, in Great Britain in 1751, the British enacted, now this is the mother country, enacted that no paper currency or bills of credit of any kind issued in any of the said colonies or plantations shall be a legal tender in payment of any private dues whatsoever within any of them. No law, wrote Adam Smith, could be more equitable. In his work, A Caveat Against Injustice, or an Inquiry into the Evil Consequences of a Fluctuating Medium of Exchange, Roger Sherman, the great statesman from Connecticut, wrote the following in 1752. He said, quote, money ought to be something of certain value, it being that whereby other things are to be valued. And this I would lay down as a principle that cannot be denied, that a debtor ought not to pay any debts with less value than was contracted for, and without the consent of or against the will of the creditor. If what is used as a medium of exchange is fluctuating in its value, it is no better than unjust weights and measures, both of which are condemned by the laws of God and man. And therefore, the largest and most universal custom could never make the use of such a medium either lawful or reasonable. But so long as we part with our most valuable commodities for such bills of credit as are no profit, we shall spend the greater part of our labor and substance for that which will not profit us. Whereas if those things were reformed, we might be as independent, flourishing, and happy a colony as any in the British Dominion. Roger Sherman, 1752. Now, your money ought to be something of a certain value. And in the Bible, we don't deal in values, we deal in weights and measures. You shall not have an unjust weight or measure in your bag. So what the money maestros have done is they have taken paper money and made it of equal value with gold and silver. They have converted us from weights and measures to values. We've been converted. We have departed from reality that a dollar is 371.25 grains of 999 fine silver. That's what a dollar is. It's always been that in this country. And we went into a fantasy land and we let some guy print up a 3-cent piece of paper and hand it to us and say, give us the same amount of labor. Give us the same amount of goods and services that you give to others for gold coin. Because this paper dollar is worth the same amount of your labor. It's worth the same amount. It's got the same value. Why? Well, because we say it does. Because we claim that it does. Well, let's take a look here at one more factor. If I can find my notes here, boys and girls. The hard facts in the United States are this. With gasoline at $2 a gallon plus, millions of Americans are beginning to discover the costs of war. And with Alan Greenspan finally starting to mumble about future higher U.S. interest rates, Americans in large numbers are now seeing higher mortgage rates and increases in fees and charges. In truth, they have been seeing the costs of everyday living climbing for close to 3 years. And though the powers that be try to tell them that inflation has not gone up by very much, this is very close to a Groucho Marx classic. What are you going to believe? Your lying eyes or what I'm telling you? Now, with the presidential and the congressional elections close to the starting block, the last thing that most Americans are ever going to hear in this election season, in the coming months until November 2nd, is any truth. 6 months of disorientation therapy lie ahead for all of us. 6 months of disorientation therapy are coming up. Now, the government is going to work its heart out and do everything possible to keep the economy afloat until they can get reelected. Then it's 2 years to the next election. Now, that's assuming, of course, that there is an election, because, you know, if there's some kind of a nuclear bomb goes off or a dirty bomb, the president can just very well declare martial law, suspend the elections, and just rule by decree, by executive order. That's coming. I don't know if it's this president, George Bush, or the next president, John Kerry, but it's coming. So you might as well get ready for it. But that's where reality is, and people don't want to look at reality. We want to look at the fantasy, the way we think it ought to be, the way we would like the world to be. And our founding fathers already tested that, and it didn't work for them, and it's not very likely that it's going to work for us. I look at this problem as the CEO of a small regional furniture manufacturing company. I did the arithmetic by about the time I was 37, learned how to count, and I said, this ship is sinking. And yes, it's true. If we could get income up and cut our costs, we could prevent this ship from sinking, but that's not going to happen because, you see, every year, the powers that be keep inflating the currency. And as they continually inflate, and as my bank continually charges me interest, when we look at the compounding factor, the rule of 72, I can't make enough profit to cover, to bail out the water coming into the ship. The boys at Enron could have figured that out. I mean, after all, you know, they're CPAs, they're accountants. Those are people who went to college and have degrees after their names. I never went to college. I don't have a degree after my name. But I'm not brain dead. And I can count. I can do my arithmetic. I'm not a real smart guy with 160 or 70 IQ. But, you know, I'm down here with the rest of the guys at about 100 or 110 or 20 or something like that. And, you know, I'm a little slow on the uptake, but I can add and subtract. And when I came to the conclusion this ship was sinking, I came to a second conclusion. I need to get off this tub. I need to get off this ship. And I need to get off this ship with as much of my assets and toys as I can get off with. Now, hang on here a minute, and let's talk about the break. I got to take a break here. We'll come back and we'll talk about, well, what are we going to do about this? As individuals down here driving trucks and washing dishes and changing baby diapers and doing all those things that we have to do down here in the real world, we're not going to change the Federal Reserve. We're not going to change President Bush. We're not going to change the Chase Manhattan Bank. But is there something that we can change about ourselves and make a meaningful change for ourselves and better our lives? The answer to that is a resounding, yep, there is. Hey, you're listening to The Law Hour. I'm your host, George Gordon. Now, The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived for your listening convenience on the internet at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Well, Joe Smith started the day early, and he set his alarm clock made in Japan for about 6 a.m., and while his coffee pot made in Japan is perking, he puts his blow dryer made in Taiwan to work and shaves with his electric razor made in Hong Kong. He puts on a dress shirt made in Taiwan, his designer jeans are made in Singapore, and a pair of tennis shoes made in Korea. After cooking up some breakfast in his new electric skillet made in the Philippines, he sits down to figure out on his calculator made in Mexico how much he can spend today. Then after setting his watch made in Switzerland for the radio made in Hong Kong, he goes out and gets in his car made in Germany and goes looking, as he has for many months, for a good-paying American job. At the end of another discouraging and fruitless day, Joe decides to relax for a while, so he puts on a pair of sandals made in Brazil, pours himself a glass of wine made in France, turns on his TV made in Japan, wonders again why it is he can't find a good-paying American job. Now, here's the bottom line. Joe, instead of a good-paying American job, why doesn't Joe go out and look for a good-paying American private business dealing in property instead of income? I know, that's a wild new concept. Now, if you'd like to tap into the power of private business, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package first? That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's free. It's educational. You can call right now the number 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to my website. It's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine when you get there and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're trying to separate fact from fantasy here in our economy. So in this series of programs called the National Debt, I pointed out to you that it isn't just the $6, $7, $8 trillion that we've got in debt at the federal level. My God, it's $150 trillion in derivatives that we're surety underwriters for. It's the trillions and trillions of dollars on our home mortgages, and more trillions and trillions of dollars of our consumer debt and credit card debt and payments on our cars and so on. We estimate that it runs somewhere around $200 trillion. We can't even service the interest on it. We owe more than the net value of everything in America, including all of the real estate. I mean, if you could sell all the real estate at book value today in the United States with all the buildings like Rockefeller Plaza, the Sears Tower, and sell your home and everything at the full rated book value, you can come up with $200 trillion. Boys and girls, the reality of it is, here in the United States of America, we need a jubilee to cancel the debt. And that's why God put a jubilee system into the economic laws. The land Sabbath, debt, forgiveness, and a jubilee law in order to overcome geometric progression. And if you don't follow that and don't practice that, if you won't practice land Sabbaths and jubilees, then your ship's going to sink at some point in time, maybe a long time. You know, our founding fathers back in colonial times operated with paper money from 1690 to 1783. They had the same result every single time. It collapsed, and they lost 90% of everything they created and produced. So in 1787, they wrote a constitution, they put a new program in, and they banned paper money. They didn't ban it from private use, they just banned it from public use. States would no longer be able to make paper money. That didn't mean that private individuals couldn't, and indeed, with the U.S. National Bank and with state-chartered banks, we had paper money in America, and it caused the same kind of pernicious trouble that it caused when the colonies were doing it publicly. Now, we have a public money system. The Federal Reserve puts out publicly, that is issued by the United States government through the Federal Reserve Bank, through a special charter, they're issuing fiat paper currency. We have been issuing paper money since 1914. And we have the same results that we got from 1690 to 1783. We've lost 96.5% of our purchasing power since 1930. 96.5%. See, our founding fathers, they only lost 90%. We've lost 96.5%. We've already got a worse result than they did. Now, my contention is we should go back to doing what worked. And since the government's not going to do it like Massachusetts did in 1749, then you and I have to do it personally, down here at the family level. And it works like a shot. I've done it. I've got many students who have done it. I don't need Walmart and the state of Missouri to make any changes at all. I don't need you to make any changes. I don't care whether you deal in gold and silver or Russian rubles or Indian rupees. You can deal in whatever you want. I'm not going to deal in those, and I'm not going to deal in them because I want to deal in hard facts. Now, let's take a look at some hard cases. There's one principle which governs all actions or activities which are, in principle, unsustainable. To give an example, if a deluded swimmer decides to swim across the Atlantic, he will surely drown. And for that reason, one does not give the swimmer a vital letter, perhaps a large money order, to deliver to London, since he's going that way anyway. You see, in principle, any activity which is unsustainable must come to an end. Any activity which is unsustainable must come to an end. Most of you people, when you put the pencil to the paper, are going to come to a conclusion that your activities are unsustainable. Even if your own finances work out, the entire scenario is unsustainable because you can't control the Federal Reserve or Congress, and they're going to continue to inflate the currency until it totally collapses. When the currency totally collapses, how are you going to pay your taxes? Let me give you a quick illustration. In 1865, at the conclusion of the Civil War, the Northern occupation forces controlled Virginia, so they controlled the political, economic, and the social conditions of the state, and they installed their own puppet government, just like we're installing our own puppet government over in Iraq. That puppet government in Virginia doubled the property tax in 1865. And boy, did that eliminate a lot of property owners. That was the purpose of doubling the tax, to eliminate property owners. People from the North could then come in and buy that property up at bargain basement prices just for the taxes due against it in many cases. 1866, they doubled the tax again. That eliminated most of the rest of the people. And then in 1867, they doubled the tax a third time. Now they doubled it. Now this is called geometric progression. 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32. Do that 32 times with a penny, and it'll total $40 million in just 32 doublings. But in 1868, they lowered the tax back to what it was in 1865, which was the objective. You raise the tax, you raise the tax, and you raise the tax, you double it three times, and you drive all of these old property owners off the land, and then you come in and buy it up at bargain basement prices, and then lower the property tax down to what you want it to be because you control the political process along with the economic process. That's what's being done to us. You have to be in a position on your piece of property to pay the doubling of the property taxes at least three times. I've prepared for four-time doubling. And the money is going to evaporate. The value of your dollar is going to hyperinflate until it inflates right out of existence. Now, how are you going to pay these taxes? Because, you see, they're going to come up with a new color money. They always do. They always have. Just because the old money is out of any backing, it doesn't have any value, we repudiate it, we'll come up with a new money and a conversion rate, just like the Russians did here a few years ago. They just closed the banks on Friday, reopened them on Monday with a new color currency. The money you had in the bank last Friday is no good, and the new money is good today. Nobody has any of the new money. And the conversion rate, you take in the old money and you give them 10, they give you one of the new money. Isn't that just real special? So you could have a 10-to-1 devaluation, 100-to-1 devaluation, but whatever it is, you're not going to be able to pay your taxes or bills. Now you can work, and you can work for the new money, and you can come up with the new money to pay your taxes, but you're not going to be able to work enough, fast enough, to come up with the money to prevent the foreclosures. And that's the key. The objective here is, how many of your toys can you save right now? You see, when the ship is sinking, or when the house is burning, It's pretty obvious that with the house on fire, we're not going to get everything out of the house. But we can get three things out of the house before we're driven out by the heat and the smoke and the flames. So which three things out of the house do we want to save? We want to save the three most valuable things that we can. Three most valuable things. The house is gone. The contents are gone. What are the three most valuable things that you have in your house that you would want to save if the house caught on fire? You probably want to save your money. You probably want to save any business records. You might want to save photographs or pictures. Something in that house, something is of value to you. Well, in the economic world, we save the most valuable things that we can get our hands on, probably the equity in our house. I was talking to a guy here the other day, one of my students, and he has a couple of cars, a couple of new cars he's making payments on. And he's done the arithmetic, and he came to the conclusion, my ship is sinking, and I need to get off. So he's in the process of saving what he can. He's not going to save everything. He can't save the cars, the house, and then pay the credit cards and save everything. But he can save something. And it's with that something that he saves that he's going to start his life over again with, isn't it? So you save everything that you can by cashing out. You cash out your stocks, you cash out your bonds, you cash out your bank accounts, you convert to gold, you bury the gold in a hole in the ground, you get rid of your equities, you pass the old maids on to somebody else. Bankruptcy may be in the cards, maybe bankruptcy isn't in the cards. Now, as the economy is deteriorating around us, there are frauds and scams that come up and abound. I mean, it's like flies in a dead carcass. And so not only do you have the government working against you, then you have the carrion eaters who are lurking around like buzzards waiting for you to die so they can jump down on your carcass and clean it. So you have some pretty formidable problems. You got the government inflating the currency, you got the banks lending to you on usury and interest, and then you got the vultures who are in here. Now that your ship is about to sink, you got the vultures lurking around trying to scam you, telling you, oh yeah, you can save this. Let me show you how. Send me your money. That's what I'm talking about here with the hard cases. Now, having established that in logic, you know, in principle, any activity which is unsustainable comes to an end. That's called logic. Now, once we've established that logic, only two other things have to be established here in the United States at the official level. How much longer can the United States keep borrowing $600 billion a year from the rest of the world to fund our trade and current account deficits? How long can we do that? How much longer can the United States federal government keep on borrowing another $600 billion plus a year to fund its own huge deficit spending? That's $1.2 trillion a year for those two debts. It's not all of our debts, that's just two. And we have to borrow that much to service the debt, to maintain our standard of living. Now, our standard of living is going to go down. We don't know when, and we don't know by how much. We don't know when because we don't know how long we can continue making these payments. And our federal government seems to think that as long as we can make our payments, everything is all right. That's an illusion. It's an illusion that's been going on here for 70 years. Can it go on for another 70? And I won't say that it can't, but I'm not going to bet on it. I don't believe it. And I don't have to bet on it. I don't have to take a risk. And then lastly, how much longer can American consumers keep spending more than they earn and then borrowing the difference? How long can that go on? In old straightforward logic, the answer to each of these three questions cannot be known in specific terms. What can be known in advance is that each of these three are going to end at some point in time. I've expected it for the last 30 years and it hasn't. I don't believe it's going to last until election time, but maybe it will. And the longer it lasts, then the better your chances of salvaging some of your equity, some of your toys, to start over again with. It's easier to start over with $10,000 in gold buried in a hole in the ground than it is to start over at zero COD with no money. It's easier to start with $100,000 in gold buried in a hole in the ground than it is to start at minus $10,000, $20,000, or $50,000. Now, as I said before, all I need to do is get you up to zero COD. If we can get your debt under control, get your debt eliminated, I'm not talking about servicing the debt. I'm talking about cashing the debt out, period. And the sooner you get the debt cashed out and get to zero COD, the sooner you can get to the real business of making money. Most people live in a delusion, believing that if they keep working, they can save more and more of their equity. When in reality, what you're in effect saying is, the longer we stay on this ship, bailing water, the greater our opportunity of saving more of our toys. That's a fantasy. The sooner you grab the three things that you can save and get into the lifeboat and get the hell away from this floundering or foundering wreck, the better it's going to be for you, and the sooner you can get started at the real business of starting over. Because the ship is going to sink, and just because you can keep the ship afloat for an extra 3 or 4 hours is not going to make a hill of beans worth of difference. In fact, I often counsel my students, you're better off to walk away from that wreck right now than to spend another minute on it. Because every minute that you spend on it, every hour, every day that you spend on it, is an hour, a day, or a minute longer that's going to take you to make your $100,000 stake. And I'm only talking about your stake. It takes you 36 months to start at zero to get your $100,000 stake. You need about $100,000 to start buying, selling, and trading with in order to make money. You've heard the old adage that says, it takes money to make money. And so you run down to the bank and you take a credit card out and borrow $10,000. Yeah, it takes money to make money, and the guy at the bank gives you $10,000 and starts charging you interest. He's making money. You're not. The illusion is that you bought in to this dream world that it takes money to make money. It does not take any money to make money. It doesn't. You can start at zero COD and start making money immediately. It's just that you don't make very much. And little by little, as you save something of what you make, as time progresses along, you'll make enough to get a stake, and then the stake is what you use to buy, sell, and trade with in order to make money. When you get $100,000 and you can buy, sell, and trade with $100,000, you can turn the $100,000 into $200,000. When you buy, sell, and trade with $200,000, you can turn the $200 into 4, and the 4 into 8, 16, 32. Now geometric progression is working for you instead of against you. When you're borrowing money and paying interest, geometric progression is working against you. When you're making payments on your house, geometric progression is working against you. We have to turn it around to get it working for us. We can't get it turned around until we can get up to zero COD. That's the hard facts. Most people cannot let go of the peanut. They get hold of the peanut and they can't let go. It isn't that they're trapped. They're free as a bird as soon as they let go of the peanut. As soon as you let go of the bank accounts, the usury, the toys, the nonsense, the illusion, the daydream, the sooner you can get down to the hard, cold facts and start making money. And everybody can do it. In fact, one of the benefits that you received under the old covenant, you know, Moses went up to Mount Sinai, went up on the mountain, negotiated a contract for us. Well, you're one of the heirs and the signs of the benefits of that contract. And one of those benefits is whatever you put your hand to do will prosper. Of course, you have to practice the terms and conditions of the contract in order to get the benefits. And you're in violation of these economic laws, you know, like paying interest. You know, one of the laws is you can't pay interest. You can't charge it and you can't pay it. And the minute you break that law, let's just test it. You buy a house for $50,000 and you make payments on it. You're making payments at around 7, 8, 9% interest. The final analysis, you're buying one house for you and two for the banker. The penalty that you pay for paying the interest is $80,000 or $120,000. That's your penalty. And that's what holds you down and keeps you from making money. You can never amass any investment capital to go out and buy, sell, and trade with. You're so busy hanging on to the peanut that you're unable to go out and make money. That's the bottom line. So I looked at my Atlantis company and I said, my God, I make $1 million a year here. And then, you know, I got bank accounts and a letter of credit and everybody looks up to me. But I looked at it just like I could look at WorldCom and Enron and say, this ship is sinking. And I can work long and hard on this ship and I can keep it floating maybe for another year or 2 years or 5 years. But why do I want to keep this hulk floating for 5 years when I can let this hulk sink? And I can go out here and get back on shore, build me a new ship, and make more than that over the next 5 years. But I got to let go of the peanut. Because as long as I hang on to the peanut, I'm trapped. I can't get away. That's why I teach at business school. That's why in our business school, we follow the Mosaic Law. We follow those principles, those economic laws. I teach those economic laws. I practice them myself. Works like a shot for me. The way I got it figured, if it works for me, it'll work for you. And when I was practicing paper money, usury, and interest, it didn't work for me, and I doubt that it's going to work any better for you. So why don't you learn from my mistake? Stop trying to reinvent the wheel. But if you're just hell-bent for leather on reinventing the wheel, you just go right ahead and do it. Don't let me get in your way, but I'm not going to waste any of my time doing the same thing. I already found out it doesn't work. Now, if the American consumer stops borrowing first, the U.S. economy and stock markets are going to go down, as do U.S. tax revenues right along with them. Without a huge spending cut, up goes the U.S. budget deficit. If the rest of the world, that's Asia mainly today, stops buying their usual huge quantities of U.S. Treasury bills, U.S. market interest rates and mortgages go up. And the U.S. stock and bond markets go down, as does the entire U.S. economy. When the United States economy starts going down, so goes down the dollar with it. And because who wants to be invested in a market with sharply contracting profit opportunities and where the internal gearing is swinging fast towards more future losses instead of future profits? Now, the situation is truly grotesque. In economic and financial terms, the entire world, to a greater or lesser degree, is watching our intrepid Atlantic swimmer splashing his way towards oblivion while actually betting that he's going to get there. Now, never has a bigger bet been laid on a more impossible outcome. So if you want to stay here and keep working hard to see if you can save your ship, go ahead. Don't let me get in the way of your happiness and success. But the failure is inevitable. And that's because America can't service the debt. It's too big now. It's out of control. Now, the war for independence exhibited a new development of the system of credit by the reckless disregard of its bounds, and promises of money were scattered over the land alike by the states and by the United States until bills, to use the words of John Adams, our second president of the United States, he said, they became as plenty as oak leaves. The paper currency of the Congress was printed in such exorbitant amounts that wages and prices skyrocketed, forcing the legislature to enact harsh wage and price controls. And when these failed, moral-sounding laws reeking of piety and patriotism were enacted in an attempt to chain the people under a penalty of violence to the government's absurd money policies. Such as, here's one of the laws, if any person shall hereafter be so lost to all virtue and regard for his country as to refuse to accept its notes, such person shall be deemed an enemy of his country. That's coming. You see, they'll inflate the currency and then they'll pass laws and tell you that you have to accept it whether you like it or not. You know, you want to avoid that like AIDS, herpes, and VD. Now, I was talking to a student here one day and he told me that when George Bush took over and the economy was headed down, she went and took their savings out of the bank and invested it in the stock market because George Bush said that was the patriotic thing to do. You know, the patriotic thing for you to do is what's good in your self-interest, what's good for your family, what is going to make your ship float higher, go farther, and cheaper and cost less and do more for you. That's the patriotic thing to do. I'm not going to change the United States of America, Chase Manhattan Bank, or Secretary of the Treasury Snow, or George Bush, or Colin Powell, or anybody else. But I'm not going to follow after these criminal, pernicious policies that they have instituted and then let them dictate to me that if I'm a person who hereafter shall be so lost to all virtue and regard for his country as to refuse to accept its notes, such person shall be deemed an enemy of his country. I'm not going to accept your worthless notes. I'm not going to participate in your fraud, your lying chicanery, your dishonesty, your theft, and your unjust weights and balances. That's my thinking. Well, we're about out of time again. Keep in mind now that the Law Hour is brought to you by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information on the Gordon Law School and the Law Hour, just go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log, the schedule, and the archives. It can be accessed through my website at georgegordon.org. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on my website. It's georgegordon.org. Remember, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. And we're just about out of time here. The signal says that my time is up, so we'll have to leave it right there. I'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. So until then, good night, friends.